If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. On February 1st, 2014, the Portia Project presented the 11th Annual Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School. The event was co-sponsored by the Oregon Justice Resource Center, the ACLU of Oregon, and Seroptimus International of Eugene. Tonight you'll hear interviews from the Women in Prison Conference. I spoke with retired law professor and founder of the Portia Project, Barbara Aldave, who spoke about her organization and the event.
This is our 11th annual conference. We were founded in 2002 and still are going strong.
Talk about the Portia Project.
The Portia Project was founded for the purpose of providing legal and other assistance to women in prison in Oregon, especially women who wanted to maintain contact with their minor children. And we do a variety of other kinds of work too, including informing the public about the costs of incarceration, the social costs, the financial costs, and ways to reduce the problems that lead to a continually rising rates of incarceration. We have this annual conference that where people can come and learn about problems, potential solutions, about ways of serving the women who are in prison and keeping them in contact with their families, and that it's much cheaper, better, more socially responsible and gratifying to help these women lead good and productive lives. And there are really good alternatives to the kind of programs that exist today.
And Barbara, how can people get involved and in touch with the Portia Project?
Well, the best way to begin would be checking out our website, www.theportiaproject.org. Portia is P-O-R-T-I-A. Many of us who founded the organization are lawyers, and we named it after the Shakespearean character Portia, who said mercy should be used to temper justice.
Kim Brokamp and John Hansen from the Oregon Department of Corrections talked about their work with the women at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison. Later, Kim Brokamp spoke about a mentor program they are proposing to help women as they reenter their communities after incarceration. I'm here with Kim Brokamp. And Kim, what is your title at ODOC?
I am the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division.
And you presented here at the Women in Prison Conference today. What did you tell the audience?
Today I was on a joint panel and we spoke to the audience about gender responsive strategies at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, programs at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and then overall just department objectives around how we approach incarceration in Oregon. We're approaching our jobs, we want to rehabilitate offenders in our custody. We value the stakeholders who help us and our partners and our contractors who work with us. We value staff safety. We value inmate safety. And, we want to make sure offenders leave better than they came.
What are some of the programs down at Coffee Creek for women?
At Coffee Creek, we have multiple programs for women, anywhere from inpatient and residential treatment programs, other cognitive restructuring programs, quilting, yoga, parenting programs, early Head Start, family preservation project, many family activities and events that keep connectivity with children. Coffee Creek has around 600 to 700 volunteers, many of them faith-based volunteers who come into the institution. It's the role model for many institutions around how to involve the community in what we do. There are so many formal programs and so many informal programs that have been started by our chaplains and interested people in the community.
What are you taking away from today's presentations?
Well, as the Department of Corrections, we can always strive to be a better partner. I'm hearing a lot today around enhancements we can do to around reentry for our offenders in the communities. It's something that we're constantly trying to work on. You know, budget constraints and resources sometimes, you know, come into play, but our commitment is that we want offenders and wraparound services when they leave our custody. Our goal is to not have them come back.
What specific reentry programs do you see a need for?
Under the umbrella of my division, transition and reentry is definitely something, it's in my umbrella of services. Anytime we can have mentors come into the facility or a mentoring program that we can connect offenders with as resources when they leave into the communities, that's always a benefit to someone's success when they leave. It's cooperation with our reentry partners. It is, specifically one element we're working on now is ensuring offenders leave with birth certificates and social security cards, pretty foundational, you know, resources to someone's reentry to society. But I think a lot of it is knowing what other resources do and coordination and not duplication of efforts. And I think that's a lot of the things I'm taking from today. There are budget constraints for the department this year and this biennium, and we continue to figure out how we're going to provide the best services and make the biggest effect on those offenders who need it.
So who would make up this mentor program?
So currently we have all kinds of mentors who do interact with our inmates. Some are religious service mentors, some are other programs we have that have mentors, but one of the sections in my division, the Office of Inmate and Community Advocacy, is going to be putting together a formal mentoring proposal that we're going to take to our executive team at the department in an effort to engage the business community, other people outside of the faith-based community to be mentors for inmates in the Oregon Department of Corrections.
And I see that as people coming in and connecting with someone about to release and following them on the outside and helping during that transition and beyond. Is that your focus?
That could be one option, or we might have mentors who come in and then do a handoff to mentors who stay outside of the facility. So we have a clear delineation. We haven't quite gotten to that point. Some mentor programs work like you just mentioned. Other ones, sometimes people aren't comfortable coming into the facility. So it's going to, that would be the optimal way, but there could be some other alternatives to that program as well.
How do people get connected with ODOC to get involved with this mentorship program you're proposing?
Any input would be received via email, or I have Kelly Raths, who is the soon-to-be administrator of this Inmate and Community Advocacy Office. We are interested in any feedback, anything people have to say. We are interested in people who have ideas. And then once we have the program, we are interested in as many people signing up as we can subscribe to.
Tana Sanchez from Red Lodge Transition Services helps primarily Native American women as they re-enter their communities after incarceration.
I was actually talking a lot about women exiting prison and unfortunately kind of being in a poverty situation, coming out without a place to live, coming out without resources to access employment, and, you know, what that means and how that feels to people and the struggle that they might go through in order to, you know, maybe make that next step and move forward.
And what do you do with Red Lodge Transitions? How do you help these women as they reenter?
Well, Red Lodge does lots of different things. We do a lot of education and a lot of just sort of interaction and mentoring on the inside, actually, prior to women coming out of prison. So that really does help to sort of set up the situation to recognize that, you know, you do have somebody on the outside that maybe can help you with different things, even if that's maybe only just a conversation now and then, depending on the resources they need. But some of the things that we do is to help women as they're literally walking out of the prison, sometimes in those gray sweatsuits. We take them across the road there to Target, you know, just across the road from Coffee Creek, and get them some clothes. Pair of underwear, some bras, something, you know, so they can feel like humans again and so they don't have to walk around in that gray sweatsuit. We then take them immediately to their PO's office, you know, to hopefully to the place that they're going to stay if we've already, you know, worked that out ahead of time. Really work with them immediately to try to get them to feel like you're back in the world now. Now what? Here's the expectations you need to meet. And then beyond that, call me tonight, you know, as soon as you can or feel comfortable with it. You know, let's talk. Let's try to figure out what the next steps are.
In 2010, the Washington State Legislature approved a bill that created alternatives to prison confinement for some nonviolent offenders who have minor children. The bill allows a judge to impose community custody along with conditions for treatment and programs for eligible offenders facing a prison sentence. Offenders already in prison who meet criteria can be returned to the community under electronic monitoring to serve about the last 12 months of his or her sentence. I spoke with Susie Lavelle from the Washington State Department of Corrections, and I spoke with Carrie Kendig, the program manager for the Children's Administration.
Is this program instead of incarceration? Is this allowing women to continue having custody of their children in the community even though they have been sentenced?
Yeah, so what it does is if a judge finds that the defendant, and it can be a father or a mother, we find that it's roughly an 80% women, mothers, 20% men that participate on our program. But if a judge finds them appropriate based on the criteria of the law, and then my staff, my community corrections officers, parole or probation officers in other states, find that the case is a good case for participation, then a judge would waive the prison sentence. So if it's 2 or 3 years or 12 months, they waive that prison sentence and impose 12 months community custody on our program. And our program is an intensive or highly monitored program where we work in phase systems where we are out with offenders in their homes every week. We work with child welfare when there's open cases to provide some levels of what could be termed wraparound services. You know, we do case consults. We develop interdependent plans where we're kind of in making an attempt to reduce duplicative services. You know, oftentimes we find that a lot of the offenders that are incarcerated are also receiving services from Children's Administration. In our program, it's about 85%. And so instead of having the offender having to go do programs for their case plan and then also for supervision, we combine those efforts so that they're not going in all these directions and can be more focused around building skills for parenting. And so the structure of our program really is based on the strengthening families model. And we do more of a family management approach rather than individual supervision. So what we're trying to do is get offenders to be what we call present parents. And that's you're clean and sober, and you're learning how to put your kids first in your daily activities. Currently, we're approaching our fourth year, and we have 12 months on the program. So right now, out of the participants who have successfully completed, which is about 206, we only have 8 new felonies that have returned to prison. So what we're looking at is less than 0.5% of the successful participants are returning to incarceration.
How did Washington State end up with such a progressive program? And we here in Oregon don't have this.
Well, you know, it's interesting because really the whole process, the whole opportunity arose out of a prison reduction idea. So, you know, between 2008, when the economy was really struggling and we were finding ourselves having some difficulty in terms of revenue coming into the state, higher incarceration rates, we had to come up with some ways to be able to reduce our prison population. And so we took a look at this population, nonviolent offenders who have been in and out of the prison system, who have children. We know that the effects to children of incarceration are just huge in terms of their inability sometimes to be able to complete school, to become involved in drugs and alcohol, and to find themselves on the same path. And so we really wanted an opportunity to impact intergenerational incarceration, and this gives us that opportunity to do that. We purposefully went out and sought partners at Children's Administration to make sure that we had children's best interest at heart. You know, we've been able to avert 44 kids from foster care as a result of the participation on this program, 8 kids returning home from foster care. That's a significant savings. And when you look at the lives of children that that can be enhanced by having their parent and in settings where they're skill building, there's appropriate oversight, people are being really successful. We've got some great success stories where we have people that have come out of prison and are starting their own businesses, are maintaining their relationships with their kids.
And partnering with child welfare, Carrie, talk about that.
Well, I think it's unique to this bill and to the program. I don't think any other state has a formalized partnership to help families that really are in both systems. And what we're able to do is look at the histories with us so we know what is the pattern of abuse and neglect, what are the risk factors with those families, and also have that layer of
what got them involved, the parents involved in the criminal justice system. And what we're able to do is share that information, which was a huge step with the legislation. It allowed us to open our system and their system and share that information, which really helped us make really informed decisions with the family and really get to what is needed to keep them on a track of not only parenting their kids, but keeping them safe and making really good decisions on their children's behalf, which is staying out of prison for the families. And it's been very effective, not only on our level, but also on the ground with the social workers actually carrying the cases and the community corrections officers and the partnerships that happen in each case in with each family.
And if we here in Oregon want to find out about this wonderful program in Washington State, how do we access this information?
Well, we have a website at www.doc.wa.gov. And if you click on the community tab, it'll take you to another page. And on the left-hand side, there's a family and offender sentencing alternative. Click on that link and it'll provide you with a lot of information around the bill. And on the right side of the page, there's a legislative link that you can go to the law and you can see kind of the circumstances or the criteria for the law and some of those requirements. And I think, you know, it's a lot of work. And I think, you know, people have in their heart in a good place around how can we really impact a system that is so interchangeable and interrelatable when we look at, you know, the reasons why we're criminality comes from and where it is. And we know that the biggest driver, you know, for crime is poverty. And we know that oftentimes there are certain things, families that struggle. You know, when you have multi-system families, they really struggle with meeting the requirements of each system. And it makes a lot of sense that we reduce those duplicative services in the best interest of kids. And it is the right thing to do in a lot of cases to really focus on that. So I'm proud of our program and what we've achieved.
When Laurie Palmer released from prison, she had no resources to buy clothing. She was tempted to steal, but knew she'd face more prison time. Already incarcerated 8 times, she was committed to turning her life around. Laurie now operates a clothes closet ministry and helps other women rebuild their lives after incarceration.
And I have been working with women actually for 17 years. I have a clothes closet ministry called Woman of Triumph. And I have been giving clothes out to Miracles and as well as Central City Concern for over 17 years now.
So people donate their clothes to you?
Well, actually, no. I have an organization that I've been picking up clothes for 17 years, which is Buffalo Exchange over on 39th and Hawthorne. They have allowed me to come in and take the clothes that they don't sell.
And how do you connect with the women inside?
Well, the women inside basically know about me because they go to Miracles and they do an NA and AA meeting, so they hear about me because I show up there. And then when they're in Central City Concern, they're in the program, the HRR program, and the people know me there because I used to work there, and so they let me come and bring clothes to their clients.
When did you release from prison?
I released from prison in 1993. I went in 1991. And when I released from prison in 93, after the 8th time, I was tempted because I didn't have any clothing to break the law. And I said, well, no, you didn't change for good this time, so you're not going to do that. And so I eventually got a job with an agency, and I was over the clothes closet. And when they closed down, they allowed me to continue doing it. And I've been doing it for 17 years now. And I know how important it is for women to have clothing when they come out, because I came out and I didn't have no clothing. I felt ashamed in my community. Nobody in my community reached out to me. And if I wanted to use agencies, I had to jump through a whole bunch of red tape. I had children in DHS. I had all these things on my plate. In order for me just to get clothes, it was like non-existent. I had to do a program, or I had to be a part of a program in order to get clothes. And then here I am standing there saying, you want me to change, but I don't have clothes. And, you know, by the grace of God, I was able to not steal or not break the law and just wait it out. And eventually He blessed me with the clothes closet, and I've been doing it ever since. And I have a passion for it because I was there. And I know that when women get out and they don't have clothes, that is very important and can cause them to go back in prison. I'm actually trying to get some funding together so I can eventually open up a boutique. I'm giving these clothes out of the back of my car off of my own income. Nobody's donating, no gas and everything. I'm on unemployment right now. And it's like I've been doing this for 17 years. You know, I don't know how to do the funding and get all that stuff together. And I'm looking to do a boutique that'll give women three sets of clothing with services behind them. And what I mean, like if I give her a business suit, you know, I want to do resume writing, I want an employment specialist to go out and get jobs before they get out, you name it. I want to do makeovers. I have this, I already got it written up.
Laurie, how did they get in touch with you? To help with this, with funding to get this started? This sounds like a wonderful project.
Well, they can actually email me if they want to get more information at Laurie, L-A-U-R-I-E, Palmer, P-A-L-M-E-R, the number 39 at yahoo.com. And my number is 503-544-9586. If you hear this story, you can call Mo over at Buffalo Exchange on 39th and Hawthorne. You know, send him a shout out.
Lisa Swart is a survivor of domestic violence, but her freedom came after she shot and killed her abusive husband and spent 12 years in prison under Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law, Measure 11. She now works with an organization called Voices Set Free to help change Oregon's domestic violence laws. Lisa was a panelist at the Women in Prison Conference, and she spoke to me about some of the changes she is proposing.
Hi, Karen. Yes, I'm working on an abuse shield law so that victims of domestic abuse have a comprehensive protection. And you'd be surprised at some of the common sense things that are not in place in our system. For example, if a victim of abuse tries to leave, if she leaves with the children, she can be charged with kidnapping.
A person is being abused by her partner and she tries to leave and takes her children, and she can be charged with kidnapping.
Correct. That shouldn't be the case under the Violence Against Women Act, but in Oregon there is no real enforcement of the Violence Against Women Act because there's no enforcement committee, no task force with sanctioning ability. So when police, judges, DAs violate this law, nobody cares. And so I'm proposing that there is a task force with teeth to make sure that this happens. I also would like to follow the lead of other states, which defines imminent danger. When there has been a pattern of abuse in the past and threats of violence in the future as ever present, and I think that's really important to allow women to defend themselves when they're in deadly situations, which looks different. And the state of Washington has made it clear that it's unconstitutional to expect a 5'4" woman to defend herself somehow miraculously without a weapon against a 6'2" intoxicated man. That violates her constitutional right to use the standard of two equal-sized men. So I'd like to see that in Oregon.
And what currently happens in Oregon if a woman defends herself against an abusive partner?
In most cases, in the rural counties particularly, she is charged with a Measure 11, and the partner who has strangled her or choked her gets a misdemeanor. So basically, he will spend a day in jail, maybe, and she'll get years in prison because she picked up a weapon, which she had to, according to the laws of physics, to defend herself. And that's made it so that we have an 85% increase in the women's prison population in the last decade. And if you realize that each person in prison costs $31,000 per year, we're looking at $93 million every year that we're spending to incarcerate women that shouldn't be incarcerated in the first place because they aren't making arrests based on patterns of abuse. They're arresting people who are defending themselves. I also think that the very first thing that should happen anytime there is a domestic violence call, whether or not an arrest is made, is that mandatory batterer intervention programs should be required. And this single step would help eliminate a lot of spending in the future and a lot of tragedy in the future because it would nip it in the bud in many cases, not all, early on, so that you don't have the more tragic escalations that occur. So I think that's another component that just must be enacted because some counties have it, but not all counties, and it should be statewide. Another one is if a domestic violence victim is convicted, I think that she or he, in some rare cases, should be able to go to the same kind of treatment center that veterans now can sometimes go to be treated for their post-traumatic stress disorder. Most abuse victims have post-traumatic stress disorder, and it goes largely untreated, and it would be far more effective to spend some time in treatment for this, because there's a 0% recidivism rate among domestic abuse survivors who have protected themselves, and even using a weapon. These women do not reoffend. So it's a waste of tax dollars to keep them locked up forever and ever if rehabilitation is the goal, which that's what the DOC claims.
The Women in Prison Conference keynote speaker was the Honorable Darlene Ortega with the Oregon Court of Appeals. Judge Ortega talked about her presentation and shared her thoughts about the event.
Well, I used a story from my own experience to illustrate why conversations like we're having today are really important. And it was around some learning I did by visiting the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility and learning about their programs there. And I talked about how it ended up influencing my handling of a particular case. But I also was sort of sober to think that it might never have happened, because there was nothing that made me do that learning. And the way we do our jobs often keeps us really locked into very narrow questions and very limited ways of thinking. And I was trying to encourage the audience of the importance of engaging in the larger conversations about how our system works and how that really requires us to be uncomfortable, because we don't always know what to do with the information that we find, and it may make us not feel very good about what we're doing right now, and that's important that we live with that feeling sometimes.
And what were some of the things that you did see at the Coffee Creek Correctional Institution when you visited?
Well, I was learning about the programs that they had for parents who were incarcerated. And I was also learning some of the statistics around when that's not happening, what the effects are in families. And I was really struck by the power of the programs, particularly the parenting programs, but also that this was fairly recent work that was being done. This was in 2005 that I visited. And I was just thinking, you know, parents have been in prison for long before this, and we just really haven't been addressing it. So it seemed to me a window into all kinds of problems that lurk in our correctional systems that we just haven't got to. I figured it was the tip of the iceberg, and everything that I've learned since then has really confirmed that impression.
We're about to hear closing remarks and remarks about reform here in Oregon. What are you taking away from this conference today?
I've learned a lot of things that are sort of specific life on the ground things for women in prison, and also around issues of domestic violence and how those things are often not handled in a very good way. That was not news to me, but I learned some specifics today around that. And I think all of this kind of learning helps me ask better questions of the records that come before me and not just accept what I'm hearing. It leaves me, of course, feeling a little unsettled, as I predicted, because I don't always know what to do with those questions, or there may not always be something I can do specifically, but I'm hopeful that it will help me be a better listener and a better decider, and hopefully push the lawyers that appear before me to ask better questions also.
You have been listening to interviews from the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School on February 1st. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you, Danielle Parks, our engineer. Good night.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascades Festival of African Films. Over 20 African films will be screened between January 31st and March 1st, 2014. Thursdays through Saturdays at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus, and Hollywood Theater. The films celebrate African achievements, expose Africa's failures, and reveal the possibilities for change and a more hopeful future. The majority of films were made by African directors and show us pictures of Africa through the eyes of Africans rather than a vision of Africa that is packaged primarily for Western viewers. That's the 24th annual Cascade Festival of African Films at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus and Hollywood Theater from January 31st through March 1st, 2014. More information can be found at the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
The time is 7:04, Monday, February 24th, 2014. Coming up next on KBOO Portland, it's Hard Knock Radio.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven.
It's history. It's history. Never been done before. Never been done
in this
before.
Country. In this country.
What up, everybody? Welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we do Venezuela 101. We find out what's really going on with the protests and what's really behind them. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about the arrest of Chapo Guzman, the drug lord in Mexico, and what's really behind that. All that and more coming up after the afternoon headlines.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Medford, Oregon teachers were back in classrooms Monday after a 16-day strike. A tentative agreement was reached between the Medford Education Association and the school district. Teachers still have to decide whether or not to ratify the agreement. The strike saw civil disobedience and also solidarity between the 500 teachers, other unions, and community supporters in Southern Oregon. Issues included salaries, working conditions, early retirement benefits, and insurance payments. The strike started February 6th. Teachers took the action after nearly a year of fruitless negotiations. The Medford district hired 165 substitute teachers, but enrollment went from 68% when the strike started to 44% at the end. Half-day schedules were used. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox Sr. says the Obama administration made